Dante as an inspiration for healing after tragedy.
Dante ends his poem with this vision of the universe as held together by love, as though it were a book of poetry, a volume where all the pages are linked together. And to me, that became a kind of inspiring thought to keep my heart open, you know, to not give in and to kind of hope. You know, that's one of the virtues that he talks about in Paradiso. Hope to be able to find love and everything that it can do to your life.
That's Joseph Luzzi. We talk with him about his moving new memoir and contemplation of Dante's Divine Comedy. It's called In a Dark Wood. Then we hear some voices from the recent marathon reading of Melville's Moby Dick, put on by the legendary Sag Harbor, New York bookstore, Canio's. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, here on this station and at writersvoice.net. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When his nearly 9 months pregnant wife was killed in a car accident, Dante scholar Joseph Luzzi found himself in that figurative dark wood that Dante wrote about in the opening verses of the Divine Comedy. Luzzi's daughter was delivered by emergency C-section. His wife died just 45 minutes later. In an instant, Luzzi found himself utterly exiled from his previous life. There was no way back, and it appeared at first, no way forward. But then, as he threw himself into his work to escape the unbearable pain of grief, Luzzi found his consolation in the book he had been studying and teaching for 20 years, Dante's Divine Comedy. Where Dante's fictional self had Virgil as his guide, Luzzi now found a like guide in Dante, whose experience of exile from his beloved Florence spoke profoundly to the dislocation Luzzi himself felt. And he found a message of hope in Dante's arduous struggle toward paradise, a struggle that ends, finally, with love. Joseph Luzzi teaches Italian at Bard College. His memoir is In a Dark Wood, What Dante Taught Me About Grief, Healing, and the Mysteries of Love. Joseph Luzzi, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
This is a really wonderful and very moving memoir, In a Dark Wood, What Dante Taught Me About Grief, Healing, and the Mysteries of Love. In 2007, your wife was killed in a terrible auto accident. Just before she died, your daughter was delivered by emergency C-section. You went through a long period of recovery from that event, and Dante was in some way your guide on that journey, especially his great work, The Divine Comedy. You entered your own region of hell in some way on that day. Let's just start out by a very brief quotation from the book. It's on page 91. I wonder if you could just read that paragraph. I was living under the spell. You know, set us up for a moment, you know, tell us where you were at when you were describing this, and then read that paragraph.
The passage that I'm about to read is in chapter 2, which is called Consider Your Seed, and it's really about my return to my hometown, Westerly, Rhode Island, where I'm actually today visiting my family. And it's right after my wife's accident and my daughter's birth. And it's about a kind of, obviously, a very sad homecoming in that I was going back to the town I'd grown up in that I'd left when I graduated high school and had gone out into the world and now was sort of coming back to it. It's a broken person completely relying on my family to help me raise Isabel, my mom, who was at the time in her late 70s, and my four sisters and my brother that really helped me, especially my mom actually co-parented with me those early years. And I talk about in this chapter what it means to be in exile in the place that's the most familiar to you in the world, that I had gone back to my hometown and a place that I loved and still do love, but during that period of grief and then mourning, I felt, you know, in exile there. And it reminded me of a very powerful canto in Dante, where his character Ulysses, which is Homer's Odysseus, goes back to Ithaca and then actually leaves. And it's this astonishing thing that Dante has him do that's difficult to understand. And now I really believe that Dante's genius was to realize that at a certain point, home can no longer be home. You know, Odysseus / Ulysses gets back to Ithaca after 20 years and finds it's no longer his place and leaves it. So the passage that I'm going to read is part of, during that period of intense grief, what the whole experience of grief felt like. I'll read now. I was living under the spell of what one author, Joan Didion, called magical thinking, the cool-minded craziness of those who expect their loved one back at any moment, ready to put on a familiar pair of old shoes. I knew that Catherine wasn't coming back for those knockout leopard print shoes she wore the night I met her in Williamsburg. Mine was a different kind of magical thinking, the sense that the world began and ended with my own suffering. My grief became an airtight shell, and contrary to the calm outward appearance I cultivated, my sorrow now defined me. Grief was choking my imagination, leaving me incapable of envisioning a different life.
Yeah, that's a very powerful passage. Like so much in your book, the inspiration that you get from Dante is not just through his literature, but also through his life. What is it about Dante's own life that resonated with you during this process?
Dante is one of those writers that, for better or for worse, mostly for better, his work is inseparable from his life. Going back to when he first started out as a poet in his 20s, his first book is an autobiography, The New Life, La Vita Nuova, about his poetic apprenticeship and his relationship with his muse Beatrice in the Italian. And writing about his life, he did write some other works as a scholar, a philosophical work, The Convivio, and a wonderful history of the Romance languages, De Vulgari Eloquentia, which is Latin for on eloquence in the vernacular. But when he comes back to his life in the Divine Comedy in around 1305, he's been exiled for a few years. And though the Divine Comedy is about so many things, you know, it's about politics, history, it's about obviously religion, the character of Dante is central to it. And as I had spent my life studying the poem and teaching it and writing about it. And Dante can be a very opaque writer because so much of his poem is about Christian doctrine, because there's so many allusions into it, to other works in it. But I started to hear his voice in a way that I never had before. And so when you ask about Dante the person, I think that I really came to understand, I believe, why he wrote the poem. And I think it had so much to do with his, not the death of Beatrice, his muse, Beatrice, but really his exile from Florence. In 1302, he was banished for life from the city, his hometown. And he spent the last 20 years of his life basically wandering around Italy, never at home. In the first few years, he tried to get back to Florence. And that was when he was probably at his lowest point ever. And it's only when he accepted his exile that he was able to basically sit down and write this remarkable poem. So I started to feel Dante the person because I heard there's a wonderful passage about his exile, which maybe I can read a couple lines from, where I actually started to hear his voice and almost could basically feel his own suffering. And that's, he's not the most forthcoming author personally, so that's not, you know, that wasn't an easy thing to do. But I realized at a certain point that that voice of his was his motivation, that voice expressed his motivation in writing the Divine Comedy. And it became a kind of symbol to me in my own despair of what you can do with your lowest, most tragic news and moment in life is to kind of struggle with it and to try and do something with it and make something out of it, you know, when you're back on your feet enough to do it. And so Dante's kind of example and his incredible courage became an inspiration to me as much as, you know, his personal courage, as much as writing became a kind of companion to me as I was working my own way out of what I call the dark wood, the selva oscura, which is Dante's image for that moment in life where you're in your great crisis, and it can go one way or the other. You know, you can sort of be defeated or find something within to get through. And so I think that, you know, his personal story, which is certainly part of the Divine Comedy, became a story that I, you know, really took to heart as I thought about what my wife's death had done to my own life.
Yeah, I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading a selection, that quote that you were referring to before.
I will. It's what's interesting about the Divine Comedy is that Dante is actually writing it in exile around 1305 to 1321 when he died. So the last almost 15 years of his life are spent writing the Divine Comedy. But he's writing about his life before he was exiled in 1300. So he finds himself in a dark wood, really, when he's at the top of his game. He was a leading poet and politician in Florence. And so he has to kind of pretend, the character Dante in the poem has to pretend he doesn't know what's going to happen to him, if that makes any sense, because there's kind of a lag of you know, a decade or so between the writing and the events of the poem. So what happens is that there's been hints of his exile earlier, but in Paradiso, when Dante meets his ancestor, Cacciaguida, who was a crusader from, you know, the 100, 200 years before Dante, he actually tells Dante exactly what's going to happen, that Dante is going to be exiled from Florence. And these are the words that he uses. And if you don't mind, I would love to read just a little bit of the Italian so you can hear the music, and then I'll translate. Does that work?
That would be delightful.
Okay. So this is Paradiso 17, and this is Cacciaguida telling Dante. He says, Tu lascerai ogni cosa diletta più caramente, e questo è quello strale che l'arco dello esilio pria saeta. Tu proverai sì come sa di sale lo pane altrui, e come duro calle lo scendere il salir per l'altrue scale. And the translation of that is, you will leave behind everything you love most dearly, and this is the arrow, the bow of exile. First, let's fly. And then he says, you will taste how salty is the bread of another man's table, and how hard it is to go up and down another man's stairs. Which is an amazing quote, because I use that image of the bow of exile. Actually, the brilliant art department at my publisher, HarperCollins, actually used it as the cover. You know, they have this image of the arrow of exile without me even giving them my input on that. And I'm so glad they chose that, because that's really what it felt like those first years. My daughter Isabel and I were sort of flung on this arrow, and as I write in the book, we weren't sure what was going to land. At first, it landed in the strangest, on the one hand, most logical of places, my hometown, but on the other hand, the strangest of places, because, you know, I never thought I would be back in the house that I grew up in as an adult parent. And the second part is powerful, because that image of you will taste how salty is the bread of another man's table, it sounds like a metaphor, right? You're going to go in exile and have to eat salty bread, something bitter on the tongue. But for anyone who's been to Florence knows, they don't make their bread with salt there. It's one of the first things that strikes you, and they haven't since the Middle Ages. So, you know, to the extent that I've been able to research it, I believe that Dante's actually choosing a literal image for a Florentine. You know, salty bread is this kind of disgusting thing on the tongue. And it's such a visceral image of what it means to be displaced. And to me, that hit home, because more than anything else, my late wife's death was, it was like falling through a trap door. It was my life, and then I found myself, same friends, same family, same job. I had a daughter now, same life, except that it wasn't. And it was this sort of strange feeling of being exiled from the life that I had. And I was, you know, for years I sort of struggled and clawed and scraped to kind of get back to what I had. Now, it was a bitter lesson to learn that, you know, you can't get back what you once had. You have to sort of, you have to build something else. But Dante's image of exile, being shot on a bow, not knowing where you land, and, you know, eating bitter food was really stuck with me.
Yeah, a dislocation, but in the same place, essentially.
Dislocation in the same place. That's right. That's what's so kind of eerie, and that's kind of why this amazing canto with Ulysses, the Greek hero, Odysseus of Dante, started to resonate with me so powerfully because, you know, he gets home after 20 years, 10 years of fighting the Trojans, 10 years of wandering. He gets back to Penelope, to Ithaca, to his son, his father. But as he says, neither devotion to my wife nor the love I owed my dear Penelope that would have made her glad could keep me from longing to gain experience of the world, you know, something along those lines. And it's sometimes the place that you know best can be the most dislocating, and that sort of summed it up for me.
So, as you say, your mom was a co-parent. Your daughter was essentially raised by your mother the first 4 years of her life, because even though you were co-parents, you had great difficulty in kind of centering your life around your daughter at the time. Tell us about that and why.
You know, that was as I was writing the book, as you can imagine, it wasn't an easy book to write. It was a book I felt I had to write because I felt as I was going through it, and I was reading all, you know, because I'm a reader and a writer and a professor of literature, it was a natural that I would turn to books about grief and mourning. I felt that there wasn't something that kind of captured what I experienced, and that I hope by writing something, other people could see their own loss in it as well. And I wanted to do something to remember my late wife and at the same time show what Dante's impact had in a positive way, how he had helped lead me through. But as I was writing it, some things were so painful to admit, and that was the hardest one. That my daughter, who ultimately saved me and rescued me, you know, being a father to her, for the first years it was very hard to embrace fatherhood. I became, as I said in the book, a widower and a father on the same day. And I think that the first year I was in shock and processing it and grieving over my wife, and my family gave me the space to do that. And I think that was necessary. But that meant that, you know, part of me was absent from day-to-day life. And raising a kid, of course, you have to put their needs before your own. And I tried to do the best I could, but it was such a difficult period that I was completely reliant on my family, especially my mom, who had raised six children of her own and, you know, had, you know, already had, when Isabel was born, 13 grandchildren. So we were kind of in the storm together for years. And I think that it took a long time for me to make, as I talk about in the book, the transition from being a father, you know, providing for my daughter, being there as much as I could, to really being her dad, to centering my life around her, to, you know, making her the focus. You know, after Catherine died, my late wife, I threw myself into my career. It was something that I needed to kind of keep going and to keep me propped up, as so many other things had fallen by the wayside. And so I felt, as anyone in that situation, I think I had a lot of misgivings. I blame myself. Why didn't I, you know, slow things down and really build a calm, quiet life with Isabel at the center of it? I think in retrospect, I just, you know, the experience was so shattering that for that first, certainly the first year was just grief. And then as kind of mourning settled in in a way that became harder because that was sort of you're back to your regular life, and people, even though they feel bad and people are incredibly supportive, you know, life goes on and your life goes on. But I was still kind of clutching at that, you know, the life that I had and wanting it back, a version of it. So it took a long time. Something that was I had dreamed of my whole life, something that I assumed would be a given to be, you know, building a life with my daughter, took a very long time to build. It took years.
Yeah, in fact, you say you were treating shades as solid things. I think is that a quote from Dante?
That is. That's from Dante, Purgatorio, where he says, "Trattando l'ombre come cosa salda," treating shades as solid things, with the experience of hugging one of the shades in Purgatory. They don't have bodies, right? So that became sort of an image for me of, you know, on the one hand, memories of my wife were totally compromised by grief because I had to sort of distance myself from her in a way to kind of just get on with life. But on the other hand, the idea of the past and, you know, the life that I had was just, it was like almost haunting, right? Because I kept wanting to get back to at least a version of what I had as I had fallen into this other life. And, you know, parenting is just so intense and all-consuming that I needed help. And, you know, my family was very heroic. They put up with not just the responsibilities of raising helping raise a newborn, but also the all the moods and you know, problems that come with someone who's dealing with grief at this level.
Yeah. Before we get to Purgatory, you have an amazing definition of hell, which resonated very powerfully for me. It's not something I'd ever thought about before. But you define it as refusing to take responsibility for one's own actions, for blaming everybody else for, you know, it's everybody else's fault, for your own problems. And, you know, I think what you've just been talking about, admitting, in fact, that you needed to get to a different place as a real dad to your daughter was a process of resolving that place in hell for you. I wonder if you could talk more about that definition and where it comes from in Dante.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, that's one of the... Dante's not an easy read, to say the least, because he's such a subtle writer. Borges says that it takes a modern novel hundreds of pages for us to get to know characters, whereas with Dante, you know, all you need is a few verses, right? And he lays the character bare. To get to that, the lines are very dense. The psychological insights are really almost hidden in there. And that's because the characters in hell can be seductively charming. And you can wonder, scratch your head, well, why is he condemning that person? That story is so convincing. That excuse is so convincing, right? When we see the lovers, Francesca and Paolo, they're genuinely in love. You know, they did commit adultery, but it was a true moment of passion that overcame them. And so, you know, sometimes you wonder, is Dante cruel? Many readers have. Is he cruel? But the closer you read, you see that all the characters tend to have one thing in common. They don't own up to what they've done. They tend to blame it on someone else. It's always someone else's fault. Francesca blames it on love. She says, love, which is quickly kindled in the gentle heart. You know, she recites this poem, and everyone has someone to blame it on. And I think that's tied to two things. One, Dante believe that the greatest gift that we have is free will, that was what God gave humanity in his Christian view. It's not, intellect is important, you know, virtue, all these things, but the true gift is that ability to really forge your own way in life and to own your decisions and take full responsibility for them. And that means even if you commit sins, crimes, you have the chance for redemption in purgatory if you genuinely repent and work towards, you know, coming to terms with what you've done. the great Dante scholar, you know, the other thing I want to mention in conjunction with that, Eric Auerbach, said that the pathos of Dante's hell is that the characters don't change. He says they're fixed for an eternity in the sin that undid them, and they replay it over and over again. And I think that's because they're still looking for a way out. They're looking to be absolved. Instead of just admitting that they had done something wrong and gone through the necessary process of expiation, penitence, humbling, etc., etc. So there's a kind of static quality that Auerbach says that that's what really breaks your heart. These people just don't change. And I think we've all met people like that, right? That they just, that one key, they play forever. And there's something, you know, for Auerbach, and I think he gets it. That's what's really heart-wrenching about Dante's hell. And for me, I think that, you know, writing the book became a way to come to terms with that. I remember at one point I was writing, I wrote something to the extent that, you know, while I was talking about co-parenting with my family, I said I was with Isabel as much as I could be. And my editor basically circled it and said, were you? ? You know, like, let's really tell what happened here. We need to know, because as I started to write the book, the journey to fatherhood wasn't really part of it. You know, because I couldn't admit it to myself. I think that's what's where Dante's psychological brilliance comes in. The things that were most, that are most painful to us, that are the most, things we're the most ashamed of, are things we can't admit to ourselves, that we hide from the world. And, you know, no one wants to admit they've failed, whether it's as a parent or a partner, whatever. I think that writing the book was a way to really re-embrace, you know, this thing that means the world to me, being the father to my daughter, but to come to terms with it honestly. And I think that that's an insight that I got from reading Dante and writing about it and writing this book.
Joseph Luzzi. We'll talk more about his memoir, In a Dark Wood, after the break. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Dante scholar and teacher Joseph Luzzi about his powerful memoir of suffering, hope, love, and the power of literature to inspire and heal the most devastating loss. It's called In a Dark Wood. Now, I have a personal connection to Dante's Inferno, as I told Luzzi.
Interestingly enough, I was named after Francesca de Rimini.
Oh, were you really? That's pretty extraordinary. That's kind of ambivalent, right?
I know.
She's a fascinating character with a you know, kind of brutal end. But well, she's an amazing character. You know, she's Dante's most famous character, probably, outside of Dante himself. And, you know, that canto is just one of the most, I think, one of the greatest pieces of writing ever, because she comes across as, when she meets Dante, she's so charming. She's so, you know, elegant, refined, and her love for Paolo seems so genuine. But Dante kind of gives her just enough verbal rope to hang herself. The more she talks, you know, she cites this poem, she blames it on love, and she's actually quoting a contemporary poem in the Sweet New Style, which was the poetic movement of the time that Dante wrote in, which basically made love a disease, right? Something that afflicted you, that you became literally lovesick. So she's lovesick. And then she says, when she starts telling Dante, she goes from saying, "Oh, animal grazioso," which is like, "Oh, gracious creature, oh, gracious animal," you know, this high language. By the end, she says, "La bocca mi baciò tutto tremante," you know, "Paolo kissed my mouth all trembling." And I tell my students, you know, that's as close to medieval erotica as you're going to get, right? This is this graphic image of physical intimacy. It seems so tame to us now from our modern perspective. But Dante knew what he was doing. He basically shows that she has lustfulness in her. And from his Christian perspective, he has no choice but to condemn her to a circle of hell. But he faints when he hears her story. And that's an amazing scene. And in class, we always talk about, why does Dante faint when he hears Francesca's story? And, you know, I think that it's because he wrote that kind of erotic lyric poetry when he was younger, and so maybe sees himself implicated in the kind of the negative effects that it could have, that it could lead people down the path of lust, which, you know, again, seems to us so not innocent today, but certainly not the kind of severe condemnation that it gets in Dante. But she's an amazing character.
Yes, and I've always felt kind of heavily burdened by that tradition of hopeless love.
Lovers, or?
Well, it's actually interesting because my mother's name was Frances, so that's part of it. But my father's name was Guido, and it was his nom de guerre. He was a Dutchman who had been in the resistance, and his closest friend was a Jewish German man who died in the camps, and he was a Dante scholar.
Hmm.
So it's kind of a long, you know, it's honoring.
How did your father spell his name?
Guido.
Yeah, that's Dante's best friend, Guido Cavalcanti, who, you know, that's pretty incredible because he dedicates his first book to Guido Cavalcanti, who basically trained Dante into being a lyric poet. And then they had some sort of falling out. No one's really sure what happened, but Dante basically signed the edict that was sent Guido into exile, and he died as a result of exile. And Dante puts his father, Cavalcante de Cavalcante, in hell. And most people see it, and I do too, as a kind of substitute for Guido. So he has a tortured relationship to his best friend, Guido. And, you know, Guido wrote that lyric love poetry about love as an illness that really is featured in the canto with Francesca. So you have quite a Dantesque lineage.
Yes, and now I have to read it. But and in fact, what is a translation that you would recommend for English readers?
Great question. You know, Dante's tough for a couple reasons. One, it's kind of a cliche, but he really does lose a lot in translation. He wrote in this incredibly musical Tuscan from the Middle Ages, which is rhyme-rich, which is filled with colloquial expressions, which became the basis for modern Italian when Italy was unified in 1861. You know, they chose Tuscan in part because it was the language of Dante, the greatest literary language in the Italian tradition. English, of course, you know, you don't get the easy rhymes because so many words in Italian end in vowels. You also lose a lot of the... Dante was very scholarly, so his work is just filled with allusions to classical literature, medieval literature, you know, theology, local politics. And unless you kind of know that context, it's hard to get into the poem. So I think it's something that's best studied in class because you kind of can pore over these details together. But one of the goals I want to do with my book is and then I'll answer your question about translation. I think Dante's a reader you need things to give you traction to get into him. And so my book, I hope, points out the themes, the issues to look for, so that you can go into the poem kind of with your eyes open and work your way through it. And, you know, you don't have to. Dante's 100 cantos with tons of characters. I've had people read it and say, by Inferno 18, their head is spinning because they've just met too many people and they can't keep track of them all. So I think that just focus on, you know, specific cantos, specific characters, and then build your understanding of the poem around that. In terms of translation, I think there's two ways to go. One, this is the way I recommend to most people, get a translation that's well done, but that gives you the Italian that you can check, even if you don't speak the language. It's nice to see the Italian and go back and forth, just to see kind of words that Dante's using and familiarize yourself with his original. So I like a translation that's a little, almost literal, of the original. And two, a translation that has notes, where the things are explained to you. So the Hollander edition is a wonderful edition. The poet Gene Hollander and the scholar Robert Hollander put it together. The Mandelbaum was a little more, takes a little more poetic license, is also a lovely edition. And an older edition is the Sinclair. I think it's from the 1930s. There's a lot of archaic language in there with these and thous, but it's just the right amount of notes, and it's a very kind of clear, direct translation. So those are three editions with notes that I can recommend. I'm not sure, actually, if the Mandelbaum has a lot of notes or the framework of it, but I have used all three of those. Then there's the poetic translations. There's a rich translation of Dante's refashioning by poets, you know, Haney, a wonderful edition is by Longfellow. That's a great edition because Longfellow was a poet and a scholar. He actually is a professor of Italian. So you kind of get both there. The language from our perspective, of course, is a little old-fashioned because it was done, in the 1860s. But there are so many poets, Pinsky, Merwin, Clive James. You can just get lost in seeing what the poets have done with Dante. So I would say between, a good edition with notes and that's more current and in a more modern language, and then have fun with the translation of Dante by poets across the centuries.
Oh, that's great advice. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Joseph Luzzi about his memoir and book about Dante as well. It's called In a Dark Wood, What Dante Taught Me About Grief, Healing, and the Mysteries of Love. So we talked about hell. Talk a little bit about purgatory. I think you mentioned a bit about that, I guess it's the process of taking responsibility. Could you go a little bit deeper into that and how that intersected with your own journey through the dark wood in this book?
When I chose the names, I did divide it into a three-part journey. I didn't dare name them after Dante because it's not in any way, an imitation or a kind of adaptation of Dante's journey. But I did feel that he captured the three stages of what I went through. So the first part I didn't call Inferno because it didn't feel like fire and brimstone, but more that, like the classical underworld, the underworld from, the Aeneid, this kind of melancholic place of shadows and ghosts. I did call the second part purgatory. I called it Mount Purgatory because I felt literally years I was in a kind of purgatory. That was after the first year of grief when it kind of became mourning, and I think it's Freud that talks about the process as work. You have to work your way through the loss. I think it's in the essay Mourning and Melancholy, the work that's required by mourning. And that just kind of nails it because it felt like climbing up a mountain. I got back, once the sort of fog of grief, burned off and I was back to my regular teaching load, back to trying to rebuild a personal life, back to, a full writing and professional life, trying to make myself myself more and more presence in Isabel's life. That was the hardest part. And it's sort of symbolized to me by these commutes that I would take every week. I was living at Bard and in Rhode Island, going back and forth. These car rides, you know, this 3.5 car ride that I took 2 times a week from Bard to Westerly. And it just felt like, you know, the word that I would describe to use it is lonely. I was very lucky in a lot of ways. I had an amazing family with, you know, that helped me. I have a rich network of friends. I'm lucky to have a great career. The Bard community was incredibly supportive. They let me know they would do whatever it took to help me get back on my feet. And yet, I felt very alone during those years. It's just part of the strange experience of loss, grief, and then mourning was that it was lonely. It's something that no one, no matter how much resources you have and how much people behind you, you have to go through it by yourself. And I think that sort of feeling of loneliness and climbing a mountain, not knowing, you know, where you would ever get to the top, captured the way I felt. And that went on for years, 3 or 4 years. And to me, Dante, Purgatory is really, in some ways, his most original creation. There'd been ideas of heaven and hell and of purgatory as well, but Dante gives this incredibly systematic view of purgatory and what it takes to rid yourself of sin to get to heaven. And he talks about it as a climbing up of a mountain, and he introduces two things which we really didn't see that much in hell. He introduces human time, in that it takes the sinners years, hundreds of years, to get through purgatory. And motion. They have to physically climb, make this exhausting climb up to Mount Purgatory. And I think that bringing in, you know, hell is so static. It's this kind of endless replay of the thing that undid you over and over again, that pathos that we were talking about of stasis. But purgatory is about the arduous climb and the kind of hard work that it takes to get out of mourning. And that's why the name Purgatory seems so fitting for part two of my book.
And then paradise, you know, you say that people don't really talk a whole lot about paradise. Most people are pretty much focused on the inferno part of it.
Yeah.
What is paradise? What is Dante's idea of what paradise is?
I think it's about two things. One would make more sense in Dante's context, and one, I think, makes more sense in a modern context for those who don't share Dante's intensely Christian doctrinal view of the universe, because we have to be clear, the Divine Comedy, Dante is an intense believer, and the poem is about a Christian soul's salvation. And a lot of paradise is about Dante understanding Christian doctrine. He's quizzed at one point, you know, on faith, hope, and charity, I believe, are the three. You know, he's got to understand Christian doctrine to be able to get all the way through heaven. And that's fair enough. That's, you know, that's an undeniable part of the poem. But I think if we move to a more modern secular context, there's something else that Paradiso is about. And that's love. It's about the power of love. Dante is not someone who, you know, he's not a sentimental guy. It's not like the poem is just oozing with easy emotion. He's a tough-minded, very intellectual, very skeptical thinker. Rigorous. You know, there's a scene where he talks about St. Francis, who had a very emotional relationship to God. And Dante kind of worships St. Francis, I think, because he doesn't have that easy, effortless emotional relationship, that he's always thinking it's got to be a kind of more intellectual and critical idea of faith. And I think that's where love comes in, that the poem is about, by the time we get to the end of it, you know, the last lines are so extraordinary. And if you want, you know, I can read them, because I think they're I think it was T.S. Eliot who said, you know, the poetry of Paradiso is as good as it gets in terms of poetry, and, which is a shame that most people don't get there, because I think a lot of people, even religious people, are kind of intimidated by the intensely theological nature of Paradiso. But it is also about love, the love of Beatrice for Dante to get him through as a guide, the love of the Virgin Mary for humanity and its suffering. And, you know, I talk about this in the book, that the mother figure for Dante is the person who absorbs the world's suffering in a way that I felt my mom helped absorb my own suffering. And the book ends with this image of a kind of cosmic view of love that holds the universe together. And when you think of the way other epic poems end, you know, with the Iliad with, you know, Hector's body being dragged around the plain of Troy by Achilles, you think of Odysseus slaying the suitors and the war that's results when, from his return to Ithaca. The end of the Aeneid is where the hero Aeneas kind of buries his sword in a defenseless enemy's throat. Dante does something completely different. He ends his poem with this vision of the universe as held together by love, as though it were a book of poetry, a volume, where all the pages are linked together. And to me, that became a kind of inspiring thought to keep my heart open, you know, to not give in and to kind of hope. You know, that's one of the virtues that he talks about in Paradiso. Hope to be able to find love and everything that it can do to your life. So I think that we may think of Paradiso as being exclusively about, okay, here, this is the religious canticle now. We've had our justice in hell. We've had our dramatic figures. Now Dante's all about being a Christian. That's true. But it is also about a much larger vision of what love can do in our lives.
Would you read that?
Sure. This is from towards the end of the book, and it's a passage that I talk about sort of when I'm speaking to Isabel directly as we look back on our time together. And if you like, I can read that little page with Isabel in it.
Yes, yes.
Dearest Isabel, you know by now that I can't retrace those first steps of ours any more than a writer can take back his first words. Your life began in the glare of an emergency room, and our first days together found me staring at you through the bars of your crib, exiled from the fatherhood I had always dreamed of, with no words to help me fathom our broken bond. But I hope you'll discover, as I have, that it's not what lands you in the dark wood that defines you, but what you do to make it out, just as you can't understand the first words of a story until you've read the last ones. Here begins the new life. When you read Dante, you'll see that these early words of his point all the way to his last ones. When he looked back on hell, purgatory, and heaven, just as I look back now on our time in the underworld, he had the courage to believe in love no matter how much he suffered, how much horror he endured. And it's with love and all its mysteries, not God or justice or free will or hope, that Dante chooses to end his poem, a vision I hope with all my heart will one day be yours. And now I'll quote the Dante. Già volgeva il mio desio il velle, sì come rota ugualmente mossa, l'amor che muove il sole e le altre stelle. Now my will and my desire were turned like a wheel in perfect motion by the love that moves the sun and the other stars. And that's the end of Dante's poem.
Oh, that's so moving. So moving. Both of those quotes from your book, In a Dark Wood. Joseph Luzzi, thank you so much for sharing this book with us and talking about it here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for letting me do so. It was a great pleasure. Thanks.
Joseph Luzzi. Go to writersvoice.net for his recommendations for translations of the Divine Comedy and to read an excerpt from his book, In a Dark Wood, What Dante Taught Me About Grief, Healing, and the Mysteries of Love. Now let's hear the poet Robert Pinsky reading the first few lines from his translation of Dante's Inferno.
Midway on our life's journey, I found myself in dark woods, the right road lost. To tell about those woods is hard, so tangled and rough and savage that thinking of it now, I feel the old fear stirring. Death is hardly more bitter. And yet, to treat the good I found there as well, I'll tell what I saw. Though how I came to enter, I cannot well say. Being so full of sleep, whatever moment it was, I began to blunder off the true path. But when I came to stop below a hill that marked one end of the valley that had pierced my heart with terror, I looked up toward the crest and saw its shoulders already mantled in rays of that bright planet that shows the road to everyone, whatever our journey. Then I could feel the terror begin to ease that churned in my heart's lake all through the night. As one still panting, ashore from dangerous seas, looks back at the deep he has escaped, my thought returned, still fleeing, to regard that grim defile that never left any alive who stayed in it.
That was Robert Pinsky reading from Dante's Inferno. That's in the Audible.com edition. Next, we go to Sag Harbor, New York, where a marathon reading of the great American classic Moby Dick happened over the weekend of July 12th. It was organized by Sag Harbor's legendary bookstore, Canio's Books. Writer's Voice went there to find out what Moby Dick meant to those who came to listen and to read.
My name is David Corsi. The subconscious archetype of Moby Dick is a study on how one perceives that most egregious threat to our physical or mental or perhaps even spiritual safety. And in this case, where this huge thing from your subconscious gobbles off a piece of your person. And Melville walks us through how such an adventure can take on a form of madness. And this is the deep gift of the wisdom of this charming piece of literature.
I spoke with the bookstore's founder, Canio Pavone, about the Moby Dick Marathon and asked him what the great white whale signified to him.
Well, to me, the white whale represents that supreme power that is stronger than all of us without being good or bad. You know, some people think of it as a god, but without using such a intimidating word like God. I just think of it, whether it's nature, which is awesome, it can destroy us, or it can just shower sunshine on us all the time. To me, that's the white whale. And fighting it, well, it's something, I guess, inside of us that tries to defy it, to defy nature. And is ultimately, I mean, we can bring it to our present day, you know, with the ecology and how it'll strike back on us if we don't behave.
If we fight it.
Yes, yeah.
And did you start the tradition of reading Moby Dick?
I did. In 1983, we had our first reading, and then we read it for about 8 years straight. But when we read it, it was around the clock and through the night. So we started, and it was always at Labor Day weekend. We'd start on a Saturday at noon and go right around the clock and end about Sunday at 5. And there were, you know, people coming and going. In the middle of the night, there were always 4 or 5 diehards.
Canio retired in 1999 and sold the bookstore to Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soka, who revived the Moby Dick reading this year on the occasion of the 35th anniversary of the founding of the bookstore. I asked Soka what was the most meaningful aspect of the marathon.
So we thought in order to celebrate the 35th anniversary, it was the right time to bring it back. Also, Sag Harbor has just formed a cultural district, including the library, the Whaling Museum, and other organizations. So we wanted to, you know, really broaden and engage the entire community by spreading it around, having a movable Moby Dick marathon as opposed to just having it be stationary. Because it's about, a marathon experience is about community, it's about hearing different voices, many different voices reading great literature. And a certain alchemy happens in the room when you go from person to person and you read these words of Melville, which are, they are Shakespearean. I mean, they're really like the, you know, the Bible of our American literature, and you never tire of them, and it says true, the morality stories, what you see or what you hear today, or what was true in Melville's time rather, is just very true today, and so it's a testament to how good literature really lasts the test of time. I mean, which is wonderful.
If you had to say one thing that was the most meaningful or important to you about Moby Dick itself, about the book, what is it?
The thing that makes the book so masterful is that it's like multidimensional. I mean, you can look at it like through a prism and see a fullness of depth in many different areas. I mean, you look at the humor of it, you look at the language of it, you look at the, you know, the encyclopedic whale education that you get by reading it. I mean, it's the whole picture. But I mean, for me, it does come back ultimately to the language. I mean, the language is so amazing, and his insights into human nature are really profound. You know, I mean, I surely wish I could put some things even like half as good as he does in terms of describing mankind, personkind, humanhood. So that I find it's sort of an ineffable brilliance and genius that he has that really just, you know, strikes me very deeply.
What the white whale was to Ahab has been hinted. What at times he was to me as yet remains unsaid. Aside from those more obvious considerations touching Moby Dick, which could not be but occasionally awaken in any man's soul some alarm, there was another thought, or rather vague, nameless horror concerning him, which at times by its intensity completely overpowered all the rest, and yet so mystical and well-nigh ineffable was it, that I almost despair of putting it in a comprehensible form. It was the whiteness of the whale that above all things appalled me. But how can I hope to explain myself here, and yet in some dim, random way, explain myself I must, else all these chapters might be naught.
Marathon co-organizer and reader Bill Chaliff. We also spoke with Canio's co-owner, Catherine Soka, Canio's founder, Canio Pavone, and audience member, David Corsi. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.